Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
In Article 1, Sections 8 and 9 of the United States Constitution, the power of the purse is vested in Congress. That means that Congress gets to control both taxation and spending, who gets money and how they spend it, through a process called appropriations. Greetings, my fellow Americans, and welcome back to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Anne Hartley, your appropriate host. Together with the Article 1 Initiative, we recently released a film called Omnibus about the current appropriations process in Congress and how it functions. I have with me Mark Strand, a professor of legislative affairs at George Washington University and the former president of the Congressional Institute, to explore the history of congressional appropriations. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Anne, for having me. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you back. All right, so let's start out with the basics. What is a congressional appropriation?
The Constitution specifically says that only Congress can appropriate money. That's basically spend. The president can't spend a penny that the Congress doesn't appropriate to him to spend. It's the one thing Congress has to do every year, which is pass a budget. If it doesn't, the government shuts down, or at least those portions of the government that haven't been appropriated. So it's the most important thing that Congress does every year, and it's the essential thing. And that was set up very deliberately by the founding fathers, who did not want an executive branch that could spend money as particularly an executive himself who could spend money willy-nilly, because they feared that would make them into a despot because they'd have the money to spend. Only the people's house can do that. And it must start in the House of Representatives, by the way. Both the House and the Senate are elected directly by the people now, but initially, as your listeners will recall, the senators were appointed by the states. So only the House of Representatives was elected by the people. And the founders felt it was very important that they are the ones who decide how to spend money. They were the guardians of the people's purse.
Wow, that's really interesting. Why is it called the power of the purse particularly? It seems like such a peculiar phrase.
Well, it really goes back to England and the use of the word purse, which we don't use that too often in America to talk about where we keep our money. But it would be the power of the wallet if they were writing it today.
Gotcha. It doesn't quite have the same ring, does it?
No.
Too bad. So why did the founders decide that the legislature, and particularly the House of Representatives, was the best possible place to put this considerable power?
You know, the most important thing about the founders, and I found this is a good explanation for almost everything they did, was they feared the concentration of power. And so the whole idea is that the people's representatives and the members of Congress were directly elected by the people every 2 years, which the rest of the world thinks we have frequent elections. As an aside, the other two choices at the Constitutional Convention were 6 months and 1 year. So we could have had elections every 6 months, but they settled on a 2-year term for members of Congress. But they wanted them because they're the ones who are in touch with the people, and the government was spending money they shouldn't be spending or wasn't spending money that they wanted to spend. The people would let them hear about it. And in those days, members of Congress didn't stay. They didn't make entire careers either. They would stay for 2 or 3 terms and then go back. So they were very highly sensitive to what their neighbors were saying. And so the idea the founders thought was that this would protect that money better if we made sure that the people had an accountability in the person that they elected directly to Congress that they could confront if they thought money was being spent poorly. And most importantly, they did not want the president having unlimited access to the Treasury for fear that they would use that to take excessive power, be like a king.
Gotcha. So is that still true today?
Well, not really. I think, unfortunately, is that the budget has become so big. The congressional districts have become so big. That's represent about 700,000 people per district. The people are not as in touch with what's going on with the spending as they probably should be, if they're responsible to understand how their taxpayers are being spent. In fact, there's a good portion of the American public's not paying taxes, so they don't really have an interest in deciding, you know, how the money is being spent. And this has sort of created a disconnect. And once it's disconnected, you know, and people aren't paying attention, it's kind of easy to just get things done without the public knowing what's happening. And I think this is what's created our budget process, where we no longer authorize programs that are supposed to be appropriated, and we lump all of our appropriations into gigantic omnibus bills that nobody could possibly know what's inside them. And to a large degree, we've lost track of the ability to hold the executive branch accountable, and certainly Congress isn't doing it right now.
Gotcha. So do you think overall the issue with the omnibus is more a question of scope, or is it a question of knowledge and understanding?
It's a very good, partly it's a shortcut to get the government funded. As I said in the beginning, this is the one thing Congress has to do is appropriate money. But Congress had originally set up some safeguards to make sure we weren't just spending money, on a piece of paper. They had an authorization process where committees are set up, and we have committees like the Armed Services Committee and the Agriculture Committee and the Transportation Committee. These committees were set up to review the items in the executive branch government. For transportation, how is the money being spent on trains? Or what's being spent on electric vehicle subsidies? Or Congress is supposed to be reviewing those programs every year to make sure that the programs are doing what they want to have done, and that the people who are spending the money are being held accountable. But Congress is no longer doing the authorization process for everything except defense, which is the one thing it does do every year. And it's spending the money without holding the executive branch accountable for what the programs are using. And so even Congress has no idea what the executive branch is doing with the money half the time, because they're not asking. There's no committee hearings where they're bringing people up. The secretary of an agency comes up and say, well, okay, what did you guys do with this program last year? Why were the agriculture subsidies so high last year compared to the previous years? Or anything that would come up. And so they're not asking the questions. And so the American public has no idea what's going on, because they don't even know what the questions are, much less what the answers are. And we've created a disconnect between the people and the budget process. And the budget process, if it was efficient and it worked, you know, people might say, well, okay, it's acceptable, but it's not working. It's a disaster in terms of, we're going to borrow over $1 trillion this year just to pay our bills. You know, that's not a healthy budget process.
It certainly doesn't sound like it. So I understand that the omnibus bill is actually just a fairly recent invention. Is that right?
You know, in the past, they used to lump whatever wasn't finished. So they would do 5 or 6 or 7 of the 12 appropriation bills. And there are 12 appropriation bills they're supposed to pass every year. And they might do 5 or 6 of them. And then the rest of the budget, they would lump into a smaller, it would be an omnibus, but it really was a combination of just those agencies and those departments that hadn't been funded properly before the fiscal year ran out. And so you had, one time we had a government shutdown when Ronald Reagan was president, but it only involved 3 departments, because the other 9 had, the appropriation process had been completed. So the whole government didn't shut down, just those 3 particular agencies. But lately, the Congress has been completely failing to do this. And now over the last 10, 15, 20 years, it's become the rule rather than the exception.
So it used to be more of a catch-all to get the leftovers that hadn't been dealt with, but it's just become used more and more.
Initially, that's exactly, Anne, that's exactly right. The whole idea was to, okay, we do as much as we can, and let's say the House and the Senate pass a bill, but the conference couldn't work out the agreement. You know, we got to get this thing done by October 1st, so let's just lump them in. And that was a convenience to do, rather than do a continuing resolution where you continue to work on the appropriation bills that weren't finished. But it has become an easy way to avoid the hard decisions that normally would go into the budget making process.
Gotcha. So let's just take a minute and talk about that normal budget making process. Where did it come from?
You know, it's interesting. We really didn't have much of a budget process for the first 100 or so years in our country. You know, because our budgets weren't that big. It wasn't until 1910 when we had a $1 billion deficit. And what we would give for a $1 billion deficit, that they said, well, let's put a little order to this. So Congress created Office of Management, Office of the Budget, and which later became the Office of Management and Budget, and the president, they required the president to submit a budget every year. And so the president would send up his budget and Congress would consider that. There were times where during our history where the authorizers and the appropriators were the same committee. They would authorize it and appropriate it. But we divided it into a separate appropriations process and the Ways and Means Committee, of course, to raise revenue. And we kind of developed this, but the current budget process really comes from 1974 Budget Act. There was a confrontation between Richard Nixon and the Congress. And it was 1974, as you recall, is the year Nixon resigned. So Nixon was already in a pretty politically weakened state. And what Nixon had been doing is saying, I'm going to impound funds, which meant you can tell me how much to spend, but if I think it's a waste of money, I'm not going to spend it. And so Nixon made the decision to not spend money that Congress was appropriating because he didn't think it was needed. Congress said, that's not your job. Your job under the Constitution is to faithfully execute the laws that we pass. And so they went and they forced a decision and they came up with a new Budget Act in 1974, which put more structure on the president and also gave Congress more of a direct power in creating the budget. The 1974 Act created the Congressional Budget Office. It created the House and Senate Budget Committees, which didn't exist before as independent committees. And so the budget committees were given the power to come up with an annual budget between the two chambers that the president doesn't even sign. So it's just the House and the Senate have to agree on a budget. They're supposed to complete this process. The president still submits a budget by the first Tuesday in February. Then the budget committee takes into account this and issues a budget which comes up with the numbers that Congress is allowed to spend. They then gives it to all the different committees and saying, okay, defense, you have $800 billion this year we want you to spend. And to agriculture, we're going to give you $50 billion. And they would create these budget levels that would go to each of the committees. The authorizing committees would then meet. They would say, okay, this program's working well, this program's not. We're staying within your limits about how much you want us to spend, but we want to cut out this program because we think it's a waste, and we want to create a new program here because we think this is badly needed. And the authorizers would complete their process. And they would do a bill. The Senate would do a bill. The president would sign the bill. And then the appropriators are supposed to then say, okay, you've shown us the programs you want to create. We will decide how much money to spend on everything you've authorized. Now, a good analogy for this is we always talked about a pitcher in water. The authorization process is creating a pitcher with its unique shape, that's going to hold the water, and that you can shape it any way you want and make it as big as you want. The appropriators decide how much water to put in. They can fund the whole thing or they can fund half of it. We've had some major bills, for instance, the No Child Left Behind Education Act, if you recall. One of the big things about it was that it put a whole bunch of mandates on the states to require all sorts of testing, but the appropriators only funded half of it. And so the states got stuck with a huge bill of federal programs they had to pay for without the federal money to go along with it. So the appropriators and authorizers don't always agree on everything about should be spending, but that was a process. The appropriators would get together. They passed 12 bills that had been authorized, all by the start of the fiscal year, which is October 1st. On October 1st, all 12 bills have been signed into law. The president and the Congress all get together in the Rose Garden, have a glass of champagne and say, we did it. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened since the late 1990s when Newt Gingrich was the speaker and Bill Clinton was the president. It was the last time we passed a balanced budget, by the way. It was all 3 years. The 96, 97, 98 budgets were all balanced. And this was done with the Democrats in charge of the White House and the Republicans in charge of Congress. So it wasn't even a one-party rule. That was the last time we've done it correctly. And incidentally, when we were doing everything, we ended up having a balanced budget because we were holding everything accountable. We weren't overspending. The economy is doing fairly well, so revenues are good. And yet, once we got away from that process, you've noticed the deficits have become worse and worse and worse. Partly is because the accountability that the budget process was supposed to provide has completely broken down.
Why has that process broken down? What happened?
Because members of Congress don't seem to want to make tough decisions. I mean, budgeting is one of the toughest things. If you ask any member of Congress, you know, you always hear members during good times love to get appointed to the Appropriations Committee because they're spending money. Right? You make a lot of friends when you're spending money. When budget times are tough, you're cutting money. Now you make a lot of enemies because you know everyone's attached. Every program in the federal government has some patron who's attached to the program. So people are going to complain when you start cutting budgets, and it's hard. And increasingly, we're seeing, and this is something I teach in my political science class, we call conditional party government, is members of Congress surrender their independence to their leadership by saying, okay, leaders, you make these decisions in exchange for us not having to take tough votes on issues and for help in our elections. And so, okay, I may not 100% agree with all the financing in this bill, but you're going to make sure I don't take tough votes that are going to call, make some great campaign commercials for my opponent. Okay, we won't do any amendments on this bill. We'll get it done that way. And the leadership takes it on, and they're the ones who shape the budget, and then we come up the final budget agreement. You notice on the debt limit agreement, it wasn't the budget committee and the appropriations committee and the Ways and Means Committee getting together. It was the speaker negotiating with the president and basically getting the sign-off of the Democrat majority leader. We had three people basically working on the budget, the president, the speaker, and the Senate majority leader, and we had 533 other people who were just observers who were going to be told to vote one way or the other when it was done. And this is the problem. Congress just needs to get back to legislating. It needs to get back to doing its job of conducting oversight over the executive branch of government, or it's going to become increasingly irrelevant.
Gotcha. So it sounds like they really need to get back to what the founders were concerned about there with the representation of the people.
They really do. I mean, obviously, one of the causes of the Revolutionary War was the overtaxation, right? Without representation. They took budget issues very seriously then, and so this was not an accident that they put these requirements into the Constitution. For instance, they said only Congress can borrow money. Why? They didn't want the president to be able to borrow as much money and to be able to then assume powers, for instance, fund military adventures without Congress's say-so. The founders knew they were very deliberate in giving Congress the power of the purse for the very good reason is that they wanted them to be accountable to the people and they didn't want to give too much power and authority to a chief executive.
Gotcha. And it kind of sounds like the omnibus process that we have today does exactly that.
It really does. They do make the Constitution requirement that they appropriate all the money, but they do it in such a fashion that it's almost impossible to hold anyone to account. There's a very famous picture of Ronald Reagan putting a stack of 3,000 pages on the lectern during the State of the Union saying, "This is ridiculous. This is what you submitted to me. I will never sign anything like this again." Of course, he did. And every president since then has, too. And as a result, the president, if they get what they want, if they get their budget priorities unauthorized, so no one's really looked at what they're doing, sure, I'll go along with it. The original thought was that, here you could force the president, some tough things on the president because, he would have to veto, he'd shut the government down with a veto rather than get at one particular problem. So we put all these things in there and say, well, if most of the bill is good and I have some bad things, I guess I'll sign it. And that is always the hope that you could sort of hold the president under sort of almost blackmail him, say, you want these programs? Okay, you're going to have to take these. But really, that's no way to legislate. There should be separate votes on all those things. If Congress believes that it should be in the budget, vote on it. If the president thinks it shouldn't be in there, veto it. But it's one thing to veto one appropriations bill. It's another thing to veto the funding for the entire government.
Absolutely. I know government shutdowns certainly are not popular.
They aren't. And I fear that the Congress might be heading towards one this year, which we should know by now whether that's going to happen. The problem is no political party ever wins who launches a shutdown, and it's a mistake. But it seems like they keep having to learn the same lesson over and over again.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. So before I let you go, where can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
Well, one thing, I have a book called Surviving Inside Congress, and there's a whole chapter in there on the budget process. So they can get that book. It's on Amazon. The sixth edition is just about out now. And they can also go to the Congressional Institute website. Tim Lang and I did a whole bunch of papers on the budget process for everything from the appropriations process to the authorization process to different reform ideas how we could fix this. And so if you're interested in that, it's sort of written in a language that I think the average person who's interested in government can grab hold of without having to go, become an economist in the process.
All right, I'll have to look that up. Well, thanks again, Mark, for joining us today. And thank you folks for listening in. It's been a delight. This has been really interesting. I feel like I understand a little better the omnibus.
Thanks for having me in.
So thank you folks for listening in. You can find our film Omnibus on our YouTube channel or at fedsoc.org. That's fedsoc.org. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.